listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
We have put together a programme which celebrates women.
We find women who are striking out on their own and achieving some extraordinary results. I'm Lyndon S.
And I'm Susie Thorpe, and we produce and present Women Making Waves.
In this edition of Women Making Waves, we tackle the topic of abuse and recovery. Lucy Da Silva was badly abused as a child and went on to suffer from drink, drug and eating disorders. Now in happier times and with a daughter of her own, Lucy tells her story.
And Lynn Asante Asari, a scientist, a former PhD student working for Cancer Research UK at St John's College, Cambridge, and now a medical student at Leicester University. Lynn was born and raised in South London and grew up wanting to be a doctor.
That's all coming up on this episode of Women Making Waves.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Lucy Da Silva has suffered the awful experience of being sexually abused as a child and subsequently went through drug and alcohol abuse, but has turned the situation around to enable her to help and support other people going through the trauma. Lucy speaks to Linda Ness.
Now I understand that I really had to hit bottom and I had nowhere else to go but up, really, or die in. You know, it was that serious.
I'm joined in the studio today by Lucy Da Silva. Lucy's story is a thing of nightmares because she's in recovery from alcohol and drug addiction, bulimia and anorexia nervosa, after living through a really abusive childhood. She's now a psychotherapist and together with her husband helps other people face their demons through the Happy as Larry group. Very many thanks for joining us today, Lucy. It's good to have you in the studio.
Thanks, Linda. Thanks for having me.
Can you give me a very brief overview of your childhood?
Very briefly. Yeah, I mean, I had a normal childhood up to about 6 or 7 years old. And then my mother remarried. And unfortunately, that person wasn't a very nice person. And from that age, I suffered with sexual abuse and physical abuse and mental abuse, all sorts of abuse up until I was in my teen years. Yeah, so it's a very brief overview of what my childhood was like.
So pretty ghastly. Did your mother, was she aware, or were you kind of frightened into not telling anybody about what was going on?
I was too frightened to say anything was happening, although the physical abuse was something that was going on that was quite apparent. And I was injured on a number of occasions and had to go to hospital and see the doctors and all sorts. But I now understand that my mum was very much controlled by this person as well. And so, you know, there's a lot that goes into being manipulated behind the scenes for her too. So, yeah, It was all of us that were suffering, really.
So you got to the point that you told someone, didn't you, at school?
Mm-hmm.
What happened after that?
Well, we were taken to a refuge so that we were protected from the perpetrator. And there was a case that was formulated and it went on for a number of months, for quite a long time. But I wasn't aware that my mother was still being controlled and manipulated by the perpetrator.
So he was still in the picture?
He was still in the picture, even though he wasn't meant to be. And unfortunately, my mum was vulnerable and she was convinced by him that I wasn't telling the truth. In a nutshell, the whole thing fell, the whole case fell, because I was told that I would be at fault if he was to go into prison and that it would be on my head if that happened. And, you know, I was 12 years old. So to put that kind of responsibility on a child, you know, it's an awful, awful thing when I think about it now.
Yeah.
And I dropped the charges. I was convinced that I was lying. I was told that I was lying, and being so young, I was so confused. And yeah, and so the whole thing fell through.
And you ended up living back with him again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And did the abuse continue at that stage?
not the sexual abuse. There was a lot of kind of exposure still happening. I mean, the environment was just a horrible environment to be in because I was just frightened all the time. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, I've, you know, obviously I developed those issues when I was older, but I don't sleep very well either still. I've had to work on a lot of that stuff because I started wearing earplugs when I was very young to block out a lot of that stuff that was going on. Ooh. You know, there was always still a lot of fighting, a lot of arguing, and it was just, you know, he took all the locks off the door so we wouldn't have any privacy, and there was a lot of it's called covert and overt stuff, you know, like stuff that went under the radar, but a lot of control, a lot of mind games, a lot of neglectful behaviour towards us. It was another nightmare, but of a different kind.
And this isn't just impacting you when you're at home, is it, presumably? Mm-hmm. Your schooling would have suffered everything, relationships would have suffered everything.
Every single thing in my life from that age up until I came into recovery was affected by those years, the stuff that went on. But going back to what you were saying, you know, my schooling suffered, my friendship suffered, I suffered as a person. It made me very introverted. I didn't have any self-confidence. I felt just dirty and at fault all the time. I'm academically very bright, but because I was also bullied into thinking that I was stupid, because I was told I was stupid and fat quite a lot too. And, you know, that convinced me that I was just worthless and I wasn't going to do well. And unfortunately, and I do feel sad saying this still now, I didn't get very good GCSEs because I couldn't focus at school.
Of course not.
So I suffered academically as well. And at 16, I was left in a house on my own and I didn't have a choice but to go out to work. So, you know, it affected my opportunities for future as well, unfortunately. Yeah.
No, it is really sad. So you then fell into taking drugs and drinking too much?
By a way of coping. I didn't understand at that age. Would you understand that? I wasn't given any real good life skills as a result of that stuff. You know, I wasn't shown that I was worth anything. And actually, I wasn't shown that my body was worth anything either. So that kind of trickled through into my behaviour. You know, I became very promiscuous at a very young age. And, you know, because I was taught that my body wasn't worth anything. The drinking started as a teenager. That was very much recreational to start with. But as the years went by, drugs came into it. And both of them went hand in hand. And then the eating disorder started very young as well. And that was my way of coping.
And that was because you were being told you were fat.
Yeah. Well, I was put on a slim fast diet when I was 11 years old. So if that's not going to convince someone that you've got an issue with your body and your weight and what you look like, then I don't know what else would. So having that drummed into you at such a young age that what you are worth is how you look and what body shape you are. Mm-hmm. You know, it's intrinsically, it was in within me to think that my value would have been placed on how I looked. Obviously, I know different now, but, you know, it's taken a long time to pick that apart. And actually, I still struggle with it today.
So what happened? What was the turnaround? How did you manage to get out of that cycle? Because it sounds like a terrible cycle.
It was a terrible cycle that went on for a number of years, a long, long time. It took for me to get really desperately unhappy and using alcohol almost daily. My eating disorder was completely out of control. It started off me overeating and being a lot bigger. And then in my 20s, it went to anorexia and then to bulimia, where I was vomiting almost daily. Mm-hmm. I was daily. But then with my drinking and my drug taking, it got to a point where I had a mental breakdown and I was signed off of work, and I drank 24 hours a day for about almost 2 weeks. I guess looking back now, it needed to happen.
Yes, a crisis.
Definitely, because I really now I understand that I really had to hit bottom and I had nowhere else to go but up, really, or die in. You know, it was that serious. Mm-hmm. And I was signed off of work and I was given a referral to a treatment centre. And even then, I still didn't think that I had a drinking problem. I guess the denial was so strong. I still saw myself.
It was part of your life as well.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, actually. The denial fits into the kind of thought process that, well, I'm young and I'm enjoying myself and I'm allowed to do this. You know, other people are doing this. Mm-hmm. But when it becomes that I'm drinking in the morning just to get rid of my shakes and, you know, the DTs and... That's not normal, you know.
No.
People don't pour vodka on their cornflakes.
No.
Not that I was doing that, but, you know, it was that bad for me.
I think when you're young, it is easy to think that everybody else is running that lifestyle as well. But actually, they're maybe just doing it on a Friday and Saturday.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the normal, inverted commas, way of drinking and having fun. And towards the end, it wasn't fun anymore.
No.
It wasn't fun.
So what happened? Did the doctors help? Was it the A&E? What actually came along?
I went to the doctors to get signed off of work on the pretense that I was suffering with depression. And actually, I say pretense, I would have been too. But I got the referral to the treatment centre when I went there, not really knowing whether I was going to do anything with it or not. And then I had that breakdown and I didn't have any choice but to go, really, because I could have gone back to work, but I was going, this cycle of everything was just, destruction was happening to every single area of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to go to the treatment centre. And it was the best decision I've ever made in my life. One of the best decisions I ever made. It was a turning point for me. I was assessed by a psychiatrist when I went there. And then they had one of the addiction counsellors come in and speak to me. And I always say that I remember this, and I'll remember this to the day I die, that she came into the room and she sat down in front of me. And there was just something about her that I thought, I can trust you. And she said something I'll always remember. I was talking about my drinking and I said, I'm really frightened. I think I'm going to die. And she said, don't worry, because we're going to look after you now.
Such a comforting thing to say. That's just what you need to hear at that point, isn't it?
I just broke down and uncontrollable.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of my recovery journey. That was the beginning. I went in there for 28 days. I was supported by the place I was working at. And, it's been a bumpy ride.
It must have been tough, though, because
really
presumably
tough.
You would have been craving substances and alcohol and whatnot that you'd got used to. Was it a kind of cold turkey thing, or was it not quite as bad as that?
I was put on a detox. I was given Librium to detox from the alcohol, because I would have had quite bad delirium tremors as a result of the amount I was drinking, which could have been dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So I was put on Librium for about a week to 2 weeks when I was in treatment. I can't remember how long it was. But the process was absolutely horrific. The detox wasn't that bad because I was helped by the medication, but the process of what I had to go through to begin to understand what I was suffering with was just awful, awfully painful, emotionally painful. The amount of trauma that I had was overwhelming, and physically I got very unwell as well as a result of it, because my body was holding on to years and years of toxic shame.
Well, I can understand that. So you talked through everything with these counsellors.
You know, only really chipping away at the surface. But it was the first opportunity for me to have my voice heard, you know, because I'd never had my voice heard. And to feel validated that this stuff had happened to me because of how it had been dealt with, I'd been convinced that not only was it my fault, but in a strange way that it wasn't true when I knew it was true, when I was told so many years that it didn't happen. And
it was like brainwashing, really, and making you question your own sanity.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that can be very, very strong, you know. And now I understand that that's what my mum went through. But yeah, so to be able to be heard and to be around people that had also been through things quite similar felt really comforting for me, and it felt like I was at home, you know. It's funny, isn't it, in a hospital, in a treatment center, I felt like I was at home.
But maybe for the first time in years you were actually able just to relax and be yourself.
Yeah. And I think that is another reason why I got physically unwell, because almost like my body just went
yeah. It's like when you work really, really hard and then you go on holiday, that's when you get your cold.
Mm-hmm. It's a similar kind of concept, really.
Yeah, but on a much, much bigger scale.
Obviously. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I will be thankful to the day I die to the counsellors that worked with me in that treatment centre and the people that I've met along the way and the new life that I was given as a result of that. And my goodness, has it been hard? And it still can be sometimes.
Is that then what made you become a psychotherapist yourself? Did you get just really interested in, and want to help other people?
Yeah, I've always, I've been a singer since a very young age and I still love to sing. But I did always want to work in a profession where I was helping other people. And I obviously, because my drinking and my drug taking was far more important to me for a long time. Because actually now I realise I was self-medicating for a long time. Mm-hmm. But I still did really want to help other people. And when I came out of treatment, I wanted to be a counsellor straight away. But, you know, I had a lot of stuff I had to work through myself before I could even think about going and doing any kind of further study. And after 16 months of being sober, I did suffer a relapse and went back into treatment because I had so much trauma that I was trying to work through.
But that's not unusual, is it?
No. And in fact, I look back now and I'm surprised I didn't relapse sooner because I was trying to deal with so much and trying to do so much to get myself recovered and cured, when now I realise that that will never happen. It's learning to cope and working through those things. So it's an ongoing process.
So you're now running the Happy as Larry group. Tell us about that.
So Happy as Larry group came about when me and my now husband, we both love to help people. And my husband is also in recovery too. We met and we started dating and we had our ups and downs as well. But sort of fast forward in a bit, my husband is a life coach and I am now a psychotherapist. And we wanted to form a company to help people, but help him from different areas. So I help from obviously a psychotherapy perspective and my husband is more motivational and goal orientated. So I will work with people to work through therapy. I will work with them in a therapeutic way. And my husband then works with people on a motivational level. And our work is done one-on-one with people. We do group work. We're doing some work with university. I'm doing a speaking engagement at Loughborough University on Wednesday. And we want to portray the message that you can come back from anything in life. We're branching out into businesses now. We do work with corporate organisations and we have a wellbeing programme which we've designed between us. And it's very successful. We did a 30-day challenge where we had 10 people trialling the first few stages of the programme. And it's been documented and recorded. And we're in the process of making a documentary out of that as well.
Really?
So, yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah. The basis of how we work is that it's self-acceptance and self-love and learning to like yourself, because it sounds very simple, but there aren't a lot of people out there that really fully like who they are. And that's what we've had to learn. For us to move forward in our lives, we've had to learn to like ourselves. But that's in a nutshell really what we do. I mean, I have my own private practice. I have my own clients.
And with psychotherapy, presumably it's anything from people wanting to stop smoking or lose weight, straight through to people who are, like you were, quite traumatised.
Yeah, I have a very varying amount of clients that bring varying amount of issues to me. One day a week I work with people who are just coming out of treatment and they're in a halfway house and they're working through their addiction issues, but they come with complex trauma. You know, some of the stuff I hear, it makes me grateful for my background. It's serious, serious stuff. And it makes me realise, you know, that I have a lot to be grateful for, despite what I had growing up. What it has given me today is an incredible life where I can help other people. So there is always something to be grateful for. And I wouldn't be doing what I do today and being able to connect with people how I do if I didn't have first-hand experience of a lot of things that had happened to me. When I have a client in front of me saying to me, I was abused seriously and I went through awful traumatic things, and I can really connect with that.
Yeah, you can empathise with that.
Absolutely.
You know what it's like.
Yeah.
You're not sitting from the other end of a, oh yeah, I've heard about these things before. You can actually understand it.
Yeah, really can. Yeah.
Do you think with children, Do we handle it very well as a society? When I know there's Childline and all of these options now that we hope that people will grab at, but I guess it's seeing it all the way through as well. And it sounds to me like the authorities didn't necessarily see it through for you, because, you know, you ended up being persuaded you were lying. Mm-hmm. And then you ended up back in a situation, although it was a little bit off the grid, I think, wasn't it? The authorities didn't know that you were staying with that man again, but you were. Mm-hmm. There didn't seem to be any checks there.
I do feel that I was let down a lot. And that is a really sad case, you know. But I do realise that there were things that they couldn't have been aware of. It's a difficult one, really, because sometimes the perpetrators can be so in control of that family home and the life that there is no way of anyone outside really knowing what's going on. Even after all that stuff happened to me, you know, I could say, you know, they could have done this and they should have done that. But when I look back at how it was managed from closed doors, you know, from how we were almost lined up and told what to say when we were seen by counsellors after the whole thing had happened, how would they have ever known? So I've had to work a lot on my acceptance. Does it still make me angry? Yes, it still makes me angry. It makes me very sad as well. But it also frightens me that it could still be going on with the young children today. And it's a very difficult one, because childhood sexual abuse is not something people talk about very often. But then that in itself gives the perpetrators the strength to carry on and do what they do, because it's such a taboo subject. So I really think that it's something that needs to be not taboo, and something that is discussed as something in an educational sense, you know, for young children, so that they understand that. I have a daughter now, she's 14 months old, and I have to say, you know, it frightens me that anything could ever happen to her. Yeah. And I say to my husband, you know, as soon as she can cognitively understand, we need to educate her that's not right in any sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Nobody has the right to ever infringe in your private areas at all. And I hope that that's the education that young children get.
So it's all we can really do as a society, isn't it? So what are your plans now? You've got this Happy as Larry group, which sounds like it's going absolutely splendidly. Mm. What's the future in store for you?
Well, as I mentioned, we're working on our wellbeing programme, which we are delivering to businesses. So we are speaking and exhibiting at the business show in London at the XL at the end of November. And we are developing our programme to work with corporate organisations. We are also speaking, I mentioned about the university, and we're going into schools. We speak at schools and we deliver workshops and seminars. And I'm developing my private practice as well, and yeah, just kind of, it's all exciting, really. I mean, it's just we work really well together, and yeah, it's just exciting to see where the business will go. My husband recently did a TEDx talk as well, which was amazing for him. So yeah, and also being a mum.
Yes, which is a huge job in itself.
It is, yeah. It's taught me a hell of a lot. And it taught me that I only really had myself to worry about before she came along. And it's really shown me and taught me a lot. But it's also brought up a lot from my childhood as well, which is good in a way, because it's more things that I realise that I need to work through from my background. It has really taught me to be very loving towards my daughter. Yeah. And I want to give her the best life that she deserves. But I'm determined not to allow that dysfunctional cycle to continue, and for her to always have the freedom to speak if she needs to speak. And she's a very, very sociable baby. And I allow her to have that freedom because she deserves that freedom.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't want my fears to stop her from being the person that she really deserves to be. So, yeah, I'll try my best.
Well, it sounds like you're absolutely sorted. Lucy, thank you very much for coming in and telling us your story. I mean, it's pretty harrowing in places, but at least it's got a fabulous outcome in the end, and that's what we like to hear.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that was Lucy De Silva talking to Linda Ness.
Lucy is such a positive person. I mean, absolute pleasure to meet a positive person, considering all the horrible things that she's been through. Mm. And she really has turned her life around. You know, when she talks about the experiences that she had, with drinking and taking drugs and bulimia and all of that kind of thing, eating disorders, because she'd been told she was fat.
Yeah.
You know, it's just awful.
I always think that she's very brave having a chat like that and being very honest about what she's been through, because you can tell she's still going through that and you'll never get over that. But conquering it is a very big struggle, and she seems to have turned that round. And she does say that she has moments where things go a bit low, but she's a very good inspiration, isn't she?
She really is.
She was fantastic.
And I think when you do get the right help, that's how you're going to feel.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Susie Thorpe talks to Lynn Asante-Asari, a scientist and former PhD student who worked for Cancer Research UK at St John's College, Cambridge, and is now a medical student at Leicester. It was also Black History Month recently, and Lynn opens up to the challenges, misconceptions and burdens felt by Black university students.
I don't think it's getting better at the graduate and sort of senior position level. So if anybody's been sort of following the news, you'll see that recently Cambridge had the biggest intake of Black undergraduates almost ever, which is absolutely amazing. But what I try to explain to undergraduates or anyone who wants to know where the issue is that at the higher level, so these are people who are going to teach you, people who are going to interview you, we're lacking diversities.
My guest today is Lynn Asante-Asari, a former PhD student for cancer research in Cambridge, actually at St John's College, and previous to that has achieved a BSc University at Warwick Biomedical Sciences and with a year in industry, and currently is a first year student in medicine at Leicester University. Now, as you can see, that sort of journey that Lynn has taken is going to be very interesting to talk about. But welcome, Lynn. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great, especially because you have travelled in from Leicester.
I've come all the way from exotic Leicester this afternoon. It wasn't too bad, but I'm very happy to be back in Cambridge.
Oh, that's really nice to hear. And it's a pleasure for Women Making Waves to have you here. So first of all, why is it back to front? Why do you have this amazing achievement, but you're doing it not on the usual journey?
Absolutely.
So tell us a bit about that, Lynn.
Yeah, so I'd always wanted to be a scientist. So I set out initially to do science and to get myself in the lab pretty much as quickly as I could. When I was on my gap year, I wasn't too sure sort of how to get there. And I had an experience with somebody being diagnosed with cancer. And that fueled my decision to go into cancer research. So I embarked on my biomedical sciences degree at Warwick, which was amazing. So many opportunities to do cancer research there. And then again, I decided to do my PhD, and I got a scholarship from Cancer Research UK, which is the best charity to do cancer research with. And that's how I then got to do real science at the University of Cambridge. But obviously midway through my PhD, something happened and I met a few doctors and I thought, I think I might do medicine. And that's how I ended up here as a first year medical student now.
At Leicester University.
At Leicester University, yeah.
What were the challenges doing a PhD?
So I think the first challenge is having a very steep learning curve. So doing a master's after your BSc is there for a reason. So it gives you a bit more research experience. It gives you a sort of entry into defending your research, learning to work with professors, doing experiments on your own. And I obviously missed that 1 year of doing a master's. So I went into my PhD with obviously a lot of passion and enthusiasm, but enthusiasm isn't enough really to get you through a PhD. You need the skills, you need the academics. And so that was a very steep learning curve, sort of learning to work on my own, develop experiments by myself, learn to explain my science to people in my lab on a regular basis, something that I didn't have as much training as maybe somebody who did a master's, but gave it a good go.
You must have had some people pushing you, because sometimes these decisions are not made by yourself. You've obviously had some influences.
Absolutely.
Who were your influences?
Yeah. So I've got two science influences and obviously one family, which is my mum's, who we'll talk about. Save the best till last. So the first was Professor Lorenzo Figerio. So he's currently the head of life sciences at Warwick Life Sciences School. And he was very influential, just sort of watching me over over my degree at Warwick. He had a lot of belief in me and just saying that, I know you're young, but you've got the skills, so I can see that in you. Just go for it. The second person was Professor Steve Jackson. So he's actually a professor at the Gurdon Institute here in Cambridge. And I did a summer project with Professor Steve before my final year. And that summer in Cambridge with Steve taught me a lot of things about being independent in research. And as we said, being confident, learning to defend your research, being able to reason why are you doing this experiment, why not the other experiment, is it cost effective, is it best for that data for the patients. And so by the time I went back to my final year, I had so much confidence just because of so many things that he taught me. And he also encouraged me to, you know, apply for Cambridge. He was also my referee. Him and Lorenzo from Warwick wrote my references. And so the two of those were instrumental. And my mum, what do I need to say?
Aww.
She wants me to do the best, and she's always been very encouraging. Yeah.
And you say confidence, but apart from the confidence has to come from somewhere. Yes, your influences too.
Yeah.
But it has to come from the work that you produce.
Yes. Yeah.
And that seems to me that you've been very passionate about medicine and becoming a doctor for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
You visited your grandmother in Ghana.
Yes.
When you were younger.
Yes.
And did that have a sort of a monumental effect on you?
Absolutely. So that was my first encounter of wanting to do something that involved working with patients in healthcare. Going to visit my grandma in Ghana when she was quite sick and seeing the sort of care that she received, I just thought, wow, you know, being nice to someone, giving someone time, speaking to them, making sure the family understand what's going on makes a massive difference to her health and to everybody else's well-being. And so that was my first encounter of realising that, oh, I think I want to be a doctor one day. I obviously went to do science and became the other kind of doctor, but that was where it started.
Yeah.
In Ghana, yeah.
Then you did obviously your degree in BSc in your science degree in biomedical sciences at University of Warwick.
Yeah.
And then of course you went on, you skipped the masters and you went to PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to become a doctor then? What changed it for you?
So at that point I was still interested in doing science. So when I went to Ghana, I did want to be a medical doctor, but that changed relatively quickly and I went down the science route. So when I started my PhD, my plan was to stay in academia, maybe stay in Cambridge one day till I'm, you know, old and settled down here. And I had no plans to go into medicine or go into medical school. So the early sort of stages of my PhD were really about doing what academics do. So being in the lab, I was very lucky to get a teaching position. So I was teaching medical students for Girton College and teaching them biochemistry, cancer, diabetes. And so I was really sort of getting involved in the academic world, doing teaching and lab work. That was always my plan. But the middle of my PhD, I started volunteering for Macmillan Cancer Care. So they have a pod in Addenbrooke's Hospital in the oncology department. So if you are a patient or a family member and you just need some support in regards to a cancer diagnosis or nutrition, anything like that, you can just go into this pod and go and speak to some of the volunteers or a nurse that might be there. And I was one of the volunteers. And a patient came in and she said that she had been experiencing sort of vomiting and diarrhea and she wasn't feeling too good. But she had finished her chemotherapy and she couldn't understand why this was still happening if she's finished her treatment. I remember this so well, and I just stood there. It seemed like the longest sort of 2 seconds of my life, but all I could think about was, well, I know the science. I know probably what's happening in your stomach and what the chemotherapy drugs are doing to your body, but there and then, I don't know what I can do to physically help you. I don't know what, you know, medicines to offer you. And that was the defining point of actually, it's good to know science, but it's good to be practical as well, be able to help people on a day-to-day basis.
This month is Black History Month,
absolutely,
isn't it? And it's really, really important to make sure we are aware of this. Now, you come from South London, which was where I'm from as well, actually.
Thank you very
good
much.
South London.
Absolutely.
We do, for all sorts of reasons. Growing up in South London and growing up in London, and seeing yourself eventually study all these amazing degrees and now you're doing medicine. In South London, do you think the opportunity is better now for students than it was years ago? Do you think it's getting better? Do you know friends who are
having that same opportunity as you?
Yeah, so I would say yes, just purely because of social media. So now you don't have to depend on your school to find role models. So you can find people like me online, and there are YouTubers who are sharing their stories. But when I was in school, all you had were your careers officers, and if they weren't sure what to do, or they didn't have the confidence in you, or if you didn't have family members who were doctors who could connect you with work experience or show you what a scientist, you know, what a scientist did and inspire you to do it, there was nowhere else for you to see those examples. And again, because it's Black History Month, you also wouldn't find female examples or Black female examples, so you're pretty much in trouble. And not many people from school who I grew up with went on to finish university or do anything like what I'm doing now. But in this day and age, thank God for social media and for people having a voice. And visibility is important for that as well, to make sure that we know, well, where are they? You know, who are they? Is Lynn in Cambridge? How would I find out that Lynn is in Cambridge? And so that visibility of doing things like this and being on social media and doing, you know, working with journalists or doing newspaper reports, on the small scale of things, they may seem like not a big deal. But actually, one person might read it. One person might listen to the podcast and think, oh, actually, I'm from South London. I want to be a doctor as well. So if Lynn did it.
Now, you mentioned that you were teaching in Girton College.
Yeah.
This was your first teaching appointment.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And it's at Girton College in Cambridge.
Absolutely.
How did this all happen and what was it like at the beginning?
Yes. So in my lab, someone in my lab was in charge of the course in Cambridge. And so that's how the opportunity came through. Now, when I started, I was a little bit fearful. Again, as we said, we went back to the age thing. You sort of look at the general age range of people teaching in Cambridge, or the what you think when you think of somebody who teaches in Cambridge. Maybe you associate a professor or a white male, or you don't think of, you know, Lynn in her early 20s from South London. So I had a fear of not seeing anyone who was like me who was doing it. But something that I learned very quickly during my PhD is that I'm there first and foremost because I'm a scientist, because I love biochemistry, I love cancer research. That's why they gave me the role, not because of anything else. So I thought, do I know the science? Yes. Do I love cancer and cancer biology? Yes. Okay, go in, teach it. So the students were also amazing, and it was just great to interact with sort of the undergraduate community as well. And I think very quickly I sort of got over looking a bit different. I think after a while I just loved being there to teach.
And you say being different and looking different. Mm. Do you think that's the case still at Cambridge, and do you think that's getting better?
It's still the case. I don't think it's getting better at the graduate and sort of senior position level. So if anybody's been sort of following the news, you'll see that recently Cambridge had the biggest intake of Black undergraduates almost ever, which is absolutely amazing. But what I try to explain to undergraduates or anyone who wants to know where the issue is that at the higher level, so these are people who are going to teach you, people who are going to interview you, we're lacking diversity. So you can bring in as many Black students, Asian students, and change the pool at the early level of their careers. But what we're not having is retention. We're not having students stay on to be academics, or students get involved in teaching. And if you don't have that, and you don't have people staying in the system, you're not changing the examples. And it's like medical school. Year on year, the majority of students are female students. So we don't have a problem with getting females into medicine. What we do have is later down the line in senior positions, that's when we begin to see things drop off. So I feel that things are changing at the early level. Diversity is getting better, but I don't think that's being retained at higher levels.
What could we do about that? What could Cambridge do about that? Is that something that you're asked? I mean, are you on any sort of committees or any areas that want your advice? I mean, I would think that you're the first person that people need to ask about the situation.
I would say... Well, no. So I don't regularly get asked, you know, as a Black female who was here doing academics, what did we do wrong, or what could we do better, or if you didn't stay, what could we have done to keep you? And it's a vicious cycle, because if the people who should be asking these questions aren't diverse and don't have an understanding of the problems, why are they going to think? Do you understand?
No, absolutely.
If I stay and I was a Black person on a panel or in admissions, I would be the one to say, hello, can you see that we don't have enough black researchers? We don't have enough Asian researchers, because I know that area and my eyes are kind of primed to see where there's a lack of diversity because I've lived it.
Yeah.
But the vicious cycle is that places like this don't have that diversity. So everybody there isn't really seeing where these problems are unless somebody speaks up and says, you know, sort of clean your eyes a bit. Can you see that we have a problem here? But once I leave, we go back to a system that isn't diverse. Who's going to represent these voices, and who's going to notice that things need to be improved? Yeah.
So I would suggest, and this is my own personal view here, that I do like quotas. And so if that means we have to have a quota for men, we have to have a quota for women, and then we have to have a quota for black, Asian. Why is that not a, why is that a problem?
Yeah, so I love this topic as well, because theoretically quotas seem good because it means year on year you will get the right number of black students or Asian students or sort of widening participation backgrounds coming in. But the downside of that is about quality. You don't want people asking and saying, well, as a black student, did you get in just because they needed to fill 10 spaces?
Yeah.
Is that why you're here? Did you really go through the rigorous process of interviews, etc.? And so that's why people generally stay away from quotas. You want to make sure that everybody coming in is going through the same vigorous process, and you don't want any black student who comes in to feel that they were just a number and they only got in because Cambridge couldn't find enough people. That's my answer to that.
Well, that's a very, very good answer. And it's nice to get an opinion, especially from you as well, Lynn. I think it's really, really important. I want to... So on that note, the Black History Month.
Yeah.
Is it important to have more than just one History Month? How do we need to improve this? Because as you just said, we need to be aware. We need people who are on the same page. So it's all very well having Black History Month. How do we change that?
Well, I think... Black History Month, I mean, there's never enough time, really. We should have Black History lifetime, but we'll do with Black History Month. The point of Black History Month is not to say that one month is enough to discuss all of the sort of achievements of black individuals, but it's just a focused time. What we're saying is that during that one month, our focus should be about finding the black people who have made movements, giving them a voice, looking back to the past, and just celebrating what we've done and what we're going to achieve. But my view on this is that black history is being made all the time. Anytime any black person is doing anything that hasn't been done before, we're continuing to make black history. So we were also discussing the example of doing the first British Sign Language tour of the Cancer Research UK Cambridge Institute, and that was done by two black women. So we've made history by doing that, and it may seem small, but again, every time as a black person you are showing up, you are going to work, you are sending that application, you're going for interview, listen, you're making history. So one month is not enough, but we're still continuing on.
Well, let's just focus on that. There's the sign language. This is a public engagement to try and get more people aware of cancer research, recognising cancer within your soul. And it's a way of publicising things into other spheres.
Yeah.
So tell us about that, because you made an amazing film with a lady called Aliko.
Aliko, yes. Me and Aliko filmed a British Sign Language tour of the beautiful Cancer Research UK Cambridge Institute. Aliko is an ambassador for the National Deaf Children's Society, and I contacted her and I said, hey, this is the best institute you're ever going to see. I speak sign language. We can communicate. Do you want to come and see what scientists do? And so she came and we did a tour of our institute. We did some lab skills, so pipetting. I taught her some facts about cancer, so 1 in 2 chance of getting cancer, risk of, you know, smoking increases risks, etc. And then I taught her some sort of science sign language words as well. And again, the point of doing that and why I learnt that sign language was just to improve access in terms of public engagement. And so my passion is access for anyone. Obviously, if you're black, if you are a woman, if you're deaf, I'm big on equal access to any community that is having any disadvantages. So sign language was to make sure that all the sort of public engagement that we do at Cancer Research UK, which is amazing, is accessible for people who are deaf or who communicate with British Sign Language.
Well said. Thank you very much, Lynn. Committing to a community in Cambridge when you first started, I would find it really hard. I came from South London. I did a degree very late in life. And if I'd gone to university at your age, I just would have melted somewhere.
Yeah.
But you don't melt. I can tell you don't melt. And strength is a very interesting word to ask. But did you have a lot of strength in that time for you? Did you know what you were going to be coming up against?
I would say no. So when I'm deciding whether to do something or not, whether to do a PhD, whether to go to med school, I don't make my decision based on challenges because I've not seen them yet. So I don't decide based on what hasn't come. I based on what I have. So I went into Cambridge thinking, you know, got the skills, happy, you know, I'm ready to learn science. And I knew a few things about Cambridge and sort of lack of diversity and what that might mean. And when I came, that's when I built some thick skin to sort of deal with it. But before getting there, I don't think you're ever strong enough to deal with challenges. You sort of switch it on when, you know, as it's going. But definitely coming from South London, Cambridge is a very different environment. It's not just about lack of diversity, because there are other places in the UK that are not diverse. That, you know, if you go further up north, you also get a lack of diversity as well. It's the tradition and it's the culture of Cambridge, and what it means to go out in Cambridge is cheese and wine versus, I don't know, in London, which is a bit more not cheese and wine. My Freshers Week in Cambridge in comparison to Leicester, it's very different.
Yeah. and on that note, dealing with having a thick skin, you said you didn't even know you had a thick skin until you had to use it, basically. Do you find now, talking to other younger, actually, I mean, you're still young and you've achieved so much, but when you were teaching at Girton College, did you find that you were giving some sort of guidance on this, how to not be knocked by it? Did they come up to you and say...
We would have discussions in regards to struggling with the workload in Cambridge. And the reality was, as a teacher, it wasn't really my responsibility to take a pastoral approach to their learning, despite the fact that being young myself, I could spot that, oh, I wish I could just take them to the side and just give them a bit more encouragement. But encouraging somebody isn't always so direct as saying to them, hey, are you okay? This is what you should do. Sometimes just giving them a friendly environment to being makes a massive difference. So I would tell a lot of jokes during my time in teaching. And yeah, I wouldn't be able to give them sort of pastoral advice because that's what their personal tutor was there for. But just giving them a change of environment that was academic, but also had a bit of, we say banter, as young people, a bit of banter, made a difference for them as well.
So from a personal point of view, obviously we're talking about what you've achieved, which is fantastic. Yeah. And then outside your work and your passion, which is obviously science and cancer and cancer research, how do you cope with your day at the end of the day when academia seems to take up quite a bit of your life, doesn't it? How do you switch off? What happens?
So I'm a big gamer. So
really?
Games, I know everyone's really surprised. And I'm like, if you're surprised, you need to get to know me. Because if you come into my room and you see my four old school game consoles, you will not be surprised at all. And this is because one of my brothers, Michael Mensah, he works for a gaming company and is into sort of app design, etc. So when I was growing up, I used to love playing computer games just to be his friend. So if anyone's been a little sister before and you know what it's like to have big brothers, you sort of want to get in the crowd. So playing games was a good way to like bond with my brothers, because I've got two brothers, William and Michael. We have a sort of 10-11 year difference, so we've got a big gap. So games was the one thing that I thought, right, I can get in with the bros. That's how it started. And then when I sort of went to uni, I had all these consoles and would get the best games for birthday presents. So my last birthday I got the Nintendo Switch. You may not know about this, but anyone who plays games will know about the latest consoles. So that was my birthday present just last year, and that's what I use to switch off, to just play games. And obviously when friends come round, we get very competitive with Mario Kart. I'm still the winner, they all know it, but that's what I do. Communal gaming.
Well, I know I'm often surprised in interviews, but that just takes it back. I mean, that's fantastic.
Listen, get yourself Mario Kart. That's where you're losing out.
I love it. How do you think, not I get the impression you won't be bothered by this, but how do you think people perceive you?
So I think when they first meet me, I don't think anyone thinks anything at all, actually. I think if someone's not read anything about me, or if they not heard about me, or know that I went to Cambridge or I'm doing a PhD, I think people will just see, oh, there's a black woman, and not really think too much. I think when people start to talk to me, they realise that I am interesting, not academically, but as you said, I've got gaming and I do all sorts of funky things here and there. And so that brings a connection almost immediately. And that's just because of, although all the work experience I've done has been hard work, it's it's allowed me to meet a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people, lots of different ages, lots of different backgrounds. And that's how I've sort of picked up different interest areas that allow me to connect with someone very quickly. So I think initially, no opinion at all. And then when we start talking, they maybe realise, oh, actually, I think she knows some stuff. And then usually I get people asking, so what actually do you do, after we've sort of laughed about Mario Kart? But they're thinking something is behind this person. And then that's when it probably does come out that, yeah, I am an academic as well. So obviously it's Black History Month, so Black students as well. And say, you know, if you're doing what you're doing because you're trying to change people's perception of you, you're going to get really tired. And all the things that you want to achieve, you're just not going to have the strength to be able to do it, because you're always going to be meeting people that are going to have different perceptions of you. And another thing just to add is that, say in environments like this or research, people sort of encourage this idea of international environments. So if you've ever sort of looked to do a PhD or go to a certain institute, they'll say, we're the best institute because we're international. And what people don't realise is that international doesn't mean that they know about diversity. So if you're coming from, I don't know, France or India or China, and you're not used to Black people, actually being in an international environment is still hard.
Yeah,
because they bring...
It doesn't
Whatever
cut
view,
it, does it?
It doesn't cut it.
Yeah.
So all they're going to know is, what do I know about a Black woman? And that's all they're going to know about you. So your duty isn't to try and change their perception. Your duty is to say, hi, this is me. I'm just Lynn. You know, I am Black and I'm a woman as well. And I'm from South London. I'm from Ghana. But I'm still just Lynn. And I hope you would, you know, sort of look past those things and just get to know me.
And your point about it being a tiring process is
tiring.
A really important thing. Mm. I think that's half the battle, isn't it?
Yeah.
When we take out that whole thought about what people think, you then get on and do what you
and
need to do.
And I do just want to touch on that, because some people might be aware of a statement where people say, Black people work harder, or as a Black woman, I have to work harder, or as a woman, I have to work harder to get to the same place. This is not saying that Black students have to do more revision to get an A star at A level, have to do more to get first class. What we're trying to say is that we go into work with a heavier burden. So I look back on my time in Cambridge and I think about days when I've had someone at college say something really inappropriate about my race or about something that they've heard going on in Africa. And then I have to go into the lab with that burden and still have the same amount of time to do the same amount of science as everybody else in that lab, but they're not carrying that same burden. That's where that's what makes you tired. It's not the work. It's not that I have to read more books just to grasp the concept. I'm just as, you know, academic and clever as my white counterparts. But it's that I'm carrying burdens and I'm having people say things to me and tell me I can't do things. Or, you know, if you're ever aware of what the media discusses when they talk about Black academics, it's always about racism, or not only less than 1% Black academics, or, you know, universities are complaining that there is racism, it's not being dealt with. It's very rare that you get good news about Black academics in the news. It's always about not enough, racism, etc. So when I see a story like that, I'll be thinking in my head, oh my gosh, I'm sure my colleagues have seen this, and I have to go into work and I'm basically a representative of that community. It's hard. That's where the burden is. It's
Absolutely.
Not the work itself. It's all the other stuff that gets put on top of you that makes it heavy.
So I get the impression then that you would like to see more said about what you can do.
That's my absolute life goal. Look, we know what's going wrong, and that's why I have no sort of time for, you know, people who get invited to talk about I don't know, lack of diversity. You know this. You don't need to be educated on this. Everyone in Cambridge, even if you've come from a background that isn't diverse, once you come into Cambridge, you know what the conversations are. You know that people are concerned about the lack of diversity. I don't need to teach you that. You're very intelligent. What we need to focus on is the celebration. What have we done well? And I always use the example of sports and music as an example, because you don't look at a Black musician and think, oh my gosh, look at Beyonce, she's Black. You've forgotten she's Black. She's just a good musician, right? And the same for sports people, that you celebrate them for what they've done well, and you don't really care whether or not what colour they're from, or whether they were from South London or not. And that's where we need to get in areas like medicine and academia. Look, celebrate us because we've got that A star and we've got first and we're doing whatever. And it's the cherry on top that we're Black and I'm a woman as well, right?
I think you're fantastic.
Oh,
I really do. I'm so pleased. And the future looks bright on everything for you, especially now that you're doing your medical degree.
I hope so, yeah. Medicine
at Leicester University.
Yeah, medicine is... I think it's two things. I'm excited for it, but, you know, obviously I have been studying for a long time, and every now and again I'll say to myself, Lynn, can you do this? You know, are you, am I going to get tired, you know, at the end? And so those thoughts are always in my mind. It will never stop me from doing it. I'll still do it. But in the back of my mind, I am aware that, hey, look, you know, you've done things a bit differently. You know, going into medical school, I've already got friends and I've already got a lifestyle sort of in place. I don't have the privilege of ignoring my friends and going out on Freshers Week and starting my whole life again. I have to try and maintain what I've been doing, what I've already been doing. And so sort of the next few months, I've got a couple of conferences that I'm going to, and I'm balancing all of this with being at medical school. So it's not...
And having a social life.
And having a social life. I try my best, but... that's the hard side of it, you know, that I've gone into medicine with a lot of stuff already that I can't just drop. And so that is a challenge, but, you know, I'm ready for it. And everyone's very nice at Leicester, so I'm happy.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have you
Thank
here,
you for
Lynn.
Having me.
You are an amazing lady.
Thank you.
We need more of you.
Aww.
Definitely need more of you.
More will come, I'm sure.
So Lynn Asante Asari, thank you so much
indeed for
coming
home
and making waves. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And that was Lynn Asante Asari talking to Susie Thorpe.
Well, I was really impressed with talking to Lynn. She loved her whole motivation in life.
Yes, you can tell that. That really comes shining through. Like a lot of the PhD students that we have spoken to before, she's really knows what she wants to do. I love that.
The teaching, that was her first teaching job at Girton College. I mean, wow.
I know.
She's only about 24 at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. They do such amazing things, these women, don't they, really? I agreed with her, you know, when you were saying about the
quotas.
The quotas.
Yes.
I absolutely agree. And it's the same with whether people are women or black or whatever. You know, I think it's got to be the best people that apply. The trick is getting more people to apply.
Yeah. But yes. Lovely, great lady, and I wish her all the best. That's all we have time for in this edition of Women Making Waves. We'd like to thank our guests, Lucy De Silva and Lynn Asante Asari. If you know of a woman who is making waves, we'd like to speak to her.
You can contact us via social media on Twitter and Facebook at WomenMW or on Instagram at Women Making Waves Radio. You can also catch up with our programmes on cambridge105.co.uk, and you can visit our website womenmakingwaves.co.uk, where you can hear all of our interviews.
Women Making Waves is a Jibber Jabber production.